crust.
That it comes right back up.
Okay. Like that for
perfect.
Now.
Perfect. Thank you. Thank you.
So it's still showing here, but not there. And then I'll get rid of all of this.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I'm Robert Leckie. I'm the Dean of the Law Faculty. Welcome to the Maxwell Cohen Moot Court. Welcome to the John P. Humphrey Lectureship or Lecture in Human Rights this afternoon. I'll be very brief. There'll be a couple more introductory speakers before we get to the real treat of the afternoon. You'll have read in the program, but I just wanted to signal that the John P. Humphrey Lectureship is one of the most prestigious lectureships housed in the Faculty of Law. We're delighted to be here. It honors, of course, John Humphrey, beloved professor here, world pioneer in human rights, who drafted the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We've had a number of prestigious speakers, and the conference is always a highlight in the academic year, and I have no doubt it will be the same today. Je le suis souligné que la conférence est une des activités par année organisées par le Centre pour les droits de la personne et le pluralisme juridique. Et je voulais aussi prendre l'occasion pour remercier toute l'équipe associée avec ce centre pour le dynamisme, pour la contribution nombreuse à la vie de la faculté. Il y a toutes sortes d'activités, d'experiential learning, des événements hautement scientifiques, des événements plus pratiques, tous qui se retrouvent au centre. C'est l'une des cœurs vraiment de la faculté de droit et j'en suis très reconnaissant. Et je trouve que les conférences prestigieuses comme celle-ci, associées aux figures pionnières en matière de droit de la personne, donnent des occasions très importantes pour nous comme chercheurs, comme enseignants, comme étudiants à la faculté de droit. On trouve dans ces conférences l'occasion de se rassembler, de partager des idées, parfois de contester nos présupposés relativement au droit de la personne, mais surtout, je trouve, on trouve de l'inspiration. Donc, un moment qui paraît de plusieurs façons assez sombre. Je trouve que se rassembler, réfléchir ensemble, se renouveler nos engagements vers les choses qui nous tiennent à cœur, je pense que c'est très important. Et j'ai aucun doute que cet après-midi, vous donnerez exactement ce genre d'occasion avec Sally Armstrong. A more official introduction of our speaker will follow in a moment. I just want to say I was very fortunate to meet Sally last night for the first time. We sat together at a meal, and it was a great pleasure and privilege for me. And I've no doubt that the time you spend with her this afternoon will be similarly for you. So we pass now the director of the Center for Human Rights and Legal Pluralism, the Oppenheimer chairholder, François Crépeau.
À l'automne 1981, j'étais étudiant dans cette faculté et j'ai été dans l'avant-dernière classe de John Humphrey, qui a, je crois, donné son dernier cours en 82. C'était avant la charte au Canada. Nous étions 10 dans ce cours électif qui était considéré, je ne sais pas si le terme existe encore chez les étudiants, on l'appelait « a Mickey Mouse course ». Parce que c'était facile, parce que ça n'avait aucune importance dans le curriculum, parce que ça n'avait aucune importance pour le barreau, pour les examens du barreau, et que de toute façon, il n'y avait pas de job en droit de l'homme à la clé. Et donc, la plupart de mes amis, de mes confrères, de mes consoeurs, me demandaient, mais pourquoi tu vas suivre ce cours, franchement? On était avant la charte. On était avant que la culture des droits de l'homme se développe au Canada, mais aussi dans le monde, d'une certaine mesure. Je peux vous dire qu'en 4 ans d'études dans le programme national à McGill, je n'avais jamais entendu parler dans la même phrase de « Aboriginal and law ». Ça n'appartenait pas aux mêmes phrases. « Queer theory et les droits de la communauté LGBTI », jamais parlé, jamais entendu parler. Le premier cours de droit de l'immigration a été créé 2 ans plus tard. Il y avait des tas de domaines du droit qui nous paraissent importants aujourd'hui, qui tout simplement n'existaient pas. La sensibilité aux droits de l'homme n'existait pas. And I think we have to thank pioneers like John Humphrey for doing the work that they've done and trying to incite students to study that, pursue a career. Not that there was any career path at the time. And in that sense, celebrating his memory by this lectureship is very important. Now, We have come a long way. We have done a lot of work. There is a human rights culture today. We're discussing issues. And at the same time, in recent years, comes another discourse, a discourse of contestation of human rights. And I was surprised, not surprised, but a bit saddened to see on the BBC on the 29th of December 2016 by Imogen Foulkes, who's a very renowned BBC reporter, an article entitled, "Are We Heading Towards a Post-Human Rights World?" We've talked about post-truth, post-Brexit, we'll talk about post-Trump at one point, but we're not. Are we heading towards a post-human rights world? Which for me means, will I have seen in my lifetime, a pre-human rights world during my studies, a human rights world during my career, and a post-human rights world when I retire? Which would be a very sad thing. To celebrate the legacy of John Humphrey, and to talk about what's happening in the field, how people talk about human rights, how people use human rights in the field, where in places where they need human rights to protect themselves and their families. And maybe to echo what Imogen Foulkes concluded in her article with, whatever flaws there may be in our current framework, if you don't have something to replace it with, you better be awfully careful about trying to tear it down. We are going to hear someone who has spent decades trying to understand what was going on the ground, what was happening, and how we can fit that in a human rights framework. And I will invite my colleague Paya Makavan to introduce our speaker for today. Thank you very much.
Mesdames, Messieurs, chers collègues, chers amis, c'est un très grand plaisir aujourd'hui de présenter notre invité distingué. How does one introduce Sally Armstrong? It is not a simple thing to do. There are many ways of describing Sally other than her tremendous accomplishments, which you can read on the program for today. There is the elusive Sally Armstrong, because when you email her or call her, you're not quite sure which time zone she's in. If she's not in Kenya, Rwanda, or Uganda, she's probably in Afghanistan or Iraq. So we're very fortunate to be able to pin Sally down and to get her here in Montreal. Then there is the disruptive Sally Armstrong, who causes a lot of trouble for a lot of people that don't particularly like her message about women's and girls' rights, and I'm told that some would even call her that tall, blonde, disruptive woman. It's one of the titles which she has earned among her many accolades. But I want to share, beyond her tremendous accomplishments, her extraordinary journalism, her best-selling books, her many honorary doctorates, including one from this university, of which she is an alumnus. I want to speak about Sally Armstrong, not just on paper, but the real Sally Armstrong. And there's nothing like spending a week together on the border of Iraq and Syria on the ISIS front lines to get to know someone. So some time ago, in my email exchange with Sally, she said, "So what are you up to?" I said, "I'm going to Iraq." She says, "Can I come?" And that was the beginning of what turned out to be quite an extraordinary journey. So only Sally can turn around on short notice and pull everything in place to come to a place like northern Iraq, which in the summer months was in a very different situation as it is today, to cover the story of the Yazidi minority, in particular the women and girls that were subject to the horrific violence that we've all now become too familiar with. And it's one thing to go on a vacation in your summer months. It's another thing to go to Iraq in the summer. The time that we were there, it was 54 degrees Celsius in Baghdad and a much cooler 47 degrees in Erbil. And we were greeted by this wonderful young man, Barzan Barzani, sits in the audience, who's now, I'm proud to say, a postdoctorate fellow here at the law faculty, who took us to these camps where you can imagine in the midst of that sweltering heat, these women and girls who have seen their loved ones murdered in front of them, who have been subject to sexual enslavement and horrific violence. You can imagine what it was like in those dusty, dirty camps. And there was Sally Armstrong, not just the consummate, skillful journalist that knows how to write a story, but also someone who had an extraordinary empathy for the people that were standing in front of her, who understood that the story doesn't end when the headlines have moved on to the next exciting story, that those who've suffered are still there with their wounds. And I think that is perhaps what is most important about what Sally does. She's not chasing the headlines, but she's involving herself in the lives of those that suffer. And she's tenacious and doesn't let go until she achieves results. And I want to just share with you this photograph of two beautiful sisters that we met in the camp together outside of Duhok in northern Iraq. And these two sisters, when they were 12 and 13, were abducted by ISIS and subject to horrific abuse. And there was Sally speaking to them and not only writing their story as a journalist, but speaking to them more like a loving mother. And to see the tears streaming from their eyes because they felt that someone cared enough to listen to their story, was quite an extraordinary experience. So all this to say that of all the different Sallys, the elusive Sally, the erudite Sally, the accomplished one, the best one is the wonderful, caring, compassionate, beautiful Sally Armstrong that I've come to know. And I will embarrass her by saying, before welcoming her, that Sally, you're my hero. So welcome to McGill.
Well, that was a pretty fabulous introduction. You know, I'm so happy to be here, partly because this is my alma mater. I have company here that shared these halls all those years ago. But you know this John Humphrey man, I have some history with him as well, and I'd like to share it to you. Can you hear? Or should I bend this thing more? John Humphrey comes from a place in New Brunswick called Hampton. And in New Brunswick, people often use all three names. They call themselves Bobby Dale DeGrasse or Donald Arthur Thompson. And indeed, John Humphrey was John Peters Humphrey. And many years ago, from my beach house in northern New Brunswick, the principal of the high school in his hometown asked me if I would come to speak at a fundraiser because they wanted to make a bronze statue to their famous local son. And I think it's so important that we celebrate the people we already know, the people who are on the ground with us. And I was delighted to go and make that speech. And I had something to say then, too, because actually I did my master's at the University of Toronto in human rights and women. And what I wanted to do was find out why the International Declaration of Human Rights didn't have very much to say about women. So I spent 2 years studying John Peters Humphrey even further. And more than that, some of you may recall, Payam certainly will, a wonderful organization called Rights and Democracy that was here in Montreal. It was a Canadian organization until it was destroyed by a government I won't mention. And that organization used to give out the John Humphrey Freedom Award every year. And in 2001, I nominated the most courageous woman I know for that award, also a mutual friend of Payam and I. Her name is Dr. Seema Samar. At the time, she was the woman who defied the Taliban. She kept her schools open for girls and she kept the clinics open for women, and she thumbed her nose at the Taliban, who threatened to kill her at every stop. Well, I nominated her for that award. She's now the chair of the Independent Human Rights Commission of Afghanistan, and she won. So you see, I really have three connections to you today. But the real reason I'm here, I know very well, is because of that fortuitous assignment I went on with Payam Akhavan. And I can tell you that having been a student of human rights and speaking to students of human rights, there is no greater pleasure than seeing an expert in the field of human rights on the ground showing us what it really means to relate to the people who are suffering. And this, I believe, is your extraordinary talent. It's one thing to be a scholar. It's another to have the ear of all the famous people in the world seem to want to listen to you. But it's quite another to put yourself at ground zero and understand what these theories of human rights really mean to the people and how they cannot go forward without it. But you mentioned Barzan Barzani, and I must say, we couldn't have pulled this off without him. You couldn't probably have launched your Truth Commission, and I could certainly not have had the story without your new postdoc fellow. I tell you, Barzan, you got more guts than Dick Tracy. And I'll say you have a heart so big that the people we were trying to interview wanted to follow you. And I'm enormously grateful for what you did for all of us at that time. So, to get to the point of why I'm here today to speak about human rights, timing is everything, isn't it? I mean, giving a human rights lecture 2 days before the inauguration of Donald Trump is sort of like giving a lecture on architecture in Aleppo, or talking to your grandchildren about the effect of sugar on Halloween night. You know, human rights have practically become part of the lexicon of common language. But on November the 8th, they were assaulted. Now, spokespeople for the unspeakable have access to huge audiences. Racism, xenophobia, misogyny, fear-mongering have become the new panacea when it comes to public rhetoric. And the scary part is that it's not just in the U.S. that people have been trumped. Brexit did it. And I dare say that there's a collection of countries in the European Union that are poised like cheetahs to advance a human wrongs assault on their own soil. Toronto Mayor Rob Ford, mayor of the city I live in, he can lay claim to creating the stage to give disgruntled people the opportunity to say things that were never considered sayable before. Suddenly, it didn't matter what facts you had. Suddenly, the manners you were taught, we hope, went out the window. And Rob Ford did it with extraordinary support, and he did it sometimes from crack dens. So for me, that was the beginning of the issue we are now solidly faced with today. Human Rights Watch put out their report, their annual report, last week, and their executive director, Kenneth Roth, says, "A new generation of authoritarian populists is seeking to overturn the concept of human rights protections, treating rights not as an essential check on official power, but as an impediment to the majority will." He goes on to say the rise of populism poses a profound threat to human rights. He says, "Trump and various politicians in Europe seek power through appeals to racism, xenophobia, misogyny, and nativism. They all claim that the public accepts violations of human rights as supposedly necessary to secure jobs and avoid cultural change or to prevent terrorist attacks." Ken Roth says, "In fact, disregard for human rights offers the likeliest route to tyranny. You and I know that to be true. But now, what are we going to do about it? You know, it makes one remember the late Isaac Asimov, a scientist and writer from the U.S., who said, "The strain of anti-intellectualism has been a constant thread winding its way through our political and cultural life, nurtured by the false notion that democracy means my ignorance is just as good as your knowledge." That's where we are today. You know, on a lighter note, well, it's not even a lighter note, electing Trump was, in my opinion, terrible. But losing Leonard Cohen was worse. Can you imagine the lyrics Leonard Cohen would have written about this current catastrophe? Remember, he's the man who wrote "Ring the Bells That Still Will Ring." "Forget your foolish offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in." Well, we're here today to talk about human rights and whether or not this age of dissent is going to affect us, the dissent of human rights and the notion that human rights are about to fall from the lexicon of common language. I'm a journalist. I work in zones of conflict. My beat is to find out what happens to women and girls in these places. So why do I think women's human rights are so important today? Because, as Cohen said, that's how the light gets in. You know, times are pointing to change. And right up there with the bully pulpits are other changes that are affecting the way we do business, and I dare say they will affect the way we will collectively deal with the Donald Trumps of this world. I'm speaking of the ascent of women, a sure antidote to the madness that has surrounded us for the last 9 weeks. And I believe the RX for these isms that we're facing today is the language of human rights. It's what John Humphrey was talking about. Create the concept, establish a precedent, give it support, and allow it to flourish. You know, in my research, doing my thesis on the Declaration, I quickly realized that it was written with the best of intentions, but the authors of the document understood from the get-go that it was going to be a tough sell. And that's why there is no iron fist of accountability in the document. It's also why there's little or no mention of women. But it was indeed a grand experiment that signaled that human justice had begun. It's taken 6 decades and dozens of new documents to right the wrongs of discluding the women. And I can tell you, as a journalist covering zones of conflict, I haven't had a good news story to tell in 30 years. But now I do. The research in my book, Ascent of Women, proves that the earth has at last shifted under the status of women. The researchers show us that the changes that are being made because of this are affecting otherwise intractable files like poverty, like violence, like interstate conflict, even culture and religion. And what's more, the power brokers are finally listening. Tell that to Donald Trump. But you know, this new wave of change is not about giving the little woman a fair shake, not at all. It's about money. Everything's about money. It was the economist Jeffrey Sachs who said, "The status of women in the economy are directly related. Where one's flourishing, so is the other. Where one's in the ditch, so is the other." Another person who was talking an awful lot about this was, heaven forbid, Hillary Clinton, while she was Secretary of State. When I was doing the research for my book, she said, "There are 39 civil wars going on in the world today. 31 of them are old wars. They keep restarting. Why? Because they end with ceasefires of exhaustion rather than ceasefires that deal with what was wrong in the first place." And said Clinton, "The same 3 things are wrong at the start of every civil war, and they are poverty, lack of education, and the status of women, the oppression of women." Nobody talked this way before. This is new on the file. And I believe that this is what is causing the earth to shift under the status of women. But you know, when I was doing this work, so many people said to me, "What are you talking about? Don't you read the paper? Can't you see there are terrible things going on?" Well, let's talk about Malala Yousafzai. Remember the girl who was 15 years old, living in the Swat Valley in Pakistan, decided that despite the Taliban telling her she couldn't go to school, she was going to go anyway, because she wanted to learn to think for herself. She didn't want to have to live her life based on what an illiterate imam was telling her she was supposed to do as a woman. So she went to school, and the cowardly Taliban shot her in the head. And that was probably should have been the end of the story, because that kind of thing goes on all the time. I mean, over there, they say, huh, who cares? It's a girl. And over here, we whisper behind our hands to our friends and say, well, my God, the way they treat their women and girls is appalling, but there's nothing we can do about it. Malala's story went into the stratosphere. She was in every paper all over the world. She was on all the news broadcasts. And remember, every time they moved her, she got back in the paper. I remember one day I was in Victoria, and CTV News called me and said, quick, go to the studio. Malala just got out of the hospital. And 5 days later, she was going back to school with a little pink backpack flung on her back. What had happened was Malala had become the world's daughter. All of us were changed, and everyone knows her. The little kids know her, the grandmothers know her, everybody knows Malala. This was an enormous change. The earth was shifting under the status of women and girls. And given that rapidly changing status, an optimist could even suggest today that the status of women are indeed at a tipping point, when age-old oppression is now seen as damaging to the economy and to the health of the community, and its opposite, emancipation, is seen as a prescription to prosperity. You know, when I was doing the research for my book, I was most anxious to find out, how did we nudge women and girls off the back burner and onto the front page of news? And I looked all around, and you know, the women's movement as we knew it was very much a Western women's movement. It was embraced by North America and Europe and Australia and such places. It was not embraced by the women of Asia and Africa. And in my research, I found that the women in Asia, who I now work with women living under Muslim laws, they are the most incredible group of women. I mean, they're outspoken, they're articulate, they have spectacular facts, they're not scared of anybody. They say what has to be said, and they become the juggernaut, really, for women in Asia and Africa. But they said to me, with the rise of Islamism, we had become the targets of the men in our own religion. We knew we had to form groups to protect ourselves. The women in Africa told me that when HIV/AIDS took on a woman's face, they said to me, we have no right to say no to sex. They said, we had to form groups, because if we didn't, we'd all be dead. I thought, well, maybe that's what caused the shift for the status of women. Now we have you have Western women, you have Asian women, African women, but that's not what it was. You know what it was? You know what caused the earth to shift under the status of women? It was Facebook. With Facebook, the first time women in the north, the south, the east, and the west could really have a conversation with one another. And what a conversation they had online. Women wearing hijab found out that despite what the fundamentalists told them, women wearing jeans were not whores after all. And women wearing jeans found out that without those women wearing hijab at the table, you were never going to get anywhere in terms of sorting out what was wrong and how you needed to move forward. You know, I believe that it was one of the worst days for fundamentalists and extremists and misogynists that day that women got together, because now women and the issues around women have become a force so powerful that everyone from presidents to pollsters is seeing women as having to be at the table in order to reduce poverty, cut conflict, improve the economy. And now there's a savvy collection of change makers who are activating this stage. And they represent millions of women who've been caught in cultural contradictions and religious dogma. Until recently, they wouldn't speak out. They were silenced by bullies who would say, this is our culture, this is our religion, this is none of your business. You know, I was one of the first journalists in Afghanistan when the Taliban took over. Can you believe? I was their worst nightmare. They used to refer to me as the big woman from Canada with the yellow hair. But they tried to convince me that this writing about their women was a dreadful thing for me to do because it was none of my business. They said, you're not from here. You're not in our culture. You're not in our religion. You have no business writing about our women. But what was happening to the women of Afghanistan was not cultural. It was criminal. And of course I was going to write about it. And soon enough, the whole world knew about it. I must say, not everyone agreed with me. I can't resist quoting two of my favorite men. One of them is Kamal Subhi. He's an academic from Saudi Arabia. And as you probably know, people like him are quite exercised about the fact that women in Saudi Arabia would like the right to drive a car here in 2017. And he's terribly exercised about that. And he went to the Legislative Assembly in Saudi Arabia, and he said to them that allowing women to drive cars will spell the end of virginity in the kingdom. I mean, really? So not long after that, I heard him on my CBC talking, and I was driving my car, and my friend Maggie was sitting in the front seat. And on the CBC, he said, what people don't understand is that women, when women drive a car, they stop ovulating. My friend Maggie said, God, I wish I'd known that. But not to be outdone, we have our own crackpots on this side of the water. I'm thinking of the redoubtable Reverend Pat Robertson, who said, the feminist agenda is not about equal rights for women. It's about a socialist, anti-family, political movement that encourages women to leave their husbands, kill their children, practice witchcraft, destroy capitalism, and become lesbians. So there. No wonder the young women I'm interviewing around the world today are sneering at old men with old ideas that are hurting everybody. They're hurting the entire village. And these women who never dared to speak out before are now challenging. They're saying, show me where it's written that I can't go to school. Well, that's not in any holy book. Show me where it's written that my mother can't go to work. That's not there either. The threads required for human rights started weaving themselves together into this quite gorgeous tapestry of change. You want a better economy? Put the women to work. Your health system's lagging? Ask about maternity and infant health care. War is your problem? Bring women to the negotiating table. Poverty is stubbornly stuck at unacceptable levels. Ask your women to work on the budget. I'm not suggesting for one second that women know more or better than men. Women know different to men. So together, we make a great collection of fixers. But until recently, the women were not invited to the table. You know, in Afghanistan, a group of young women started a group called Young Women for Change. They told me 67% of the population of Afghanistan is under the age of 30. They said, we never started a war. We never fought a war. We hate these old rules that are so harmful and hurtful to people. And they said, we intend to make change, and we have the tools to do it because we're all on Facebook. But I said to them, you know, the fundamentalists in Afghanistan go nearly berserk when you talk about change. They accuse you of trying to westernize Afghanistan. You know, if it happens to be on time or less corrupt or workable, it's got to be Western. Anyway, I said to these kids, how do you deal with the fundamentalists who come after you with that? They didn't skip a beat. They said, we tell them, you think girls' education is Western? You think human rights are Western? You think treating people decently is Western? If that's Western, what's Eastern? Young people, many of you sitting here today, you're the ones with the courage and the nerve and the belief that you can make the earth shift, that you can make the changes that most certainly have to be made today. But you know, despite the tremendous changes in the status of women, we're not at the finish line, not here and not there. When you consider that violence against women in Canada costs this country $7.4 billion a year, you know we have a distance to travel. When you follow the plight of Indigenous women, particularly in Val-d'Or, Quebec, and you know they're not safe when the police are around, you know we have a distance to travel. But I can tell you, as I learned while on assignment with Professor Akhovin last summer, one of the worst worst abuses of women on the international scene is what is happening today to the Yazidi women in northern Iraq. It was ignored for such a long time. It started on August the 3rd, 2014. Andrew Potter gave me that assignment. He said, I can't send you over there, but get on the phone and find out what's going on. You know what? One of the things wrong with journalism today is your McGill got you and we lost you. You have such vision for our business. But back to the Yazidis. My God, what a story. This is the 73rd genocide of the Yazidis since the Ottomans ruled the empire. There's only about 600,000 of them left, maybe only 500,000. They're not doing a lot of census over there. They're practically an endangered species. The first woman I spoke to, she said to me, why should I tell you my story? I told it before and nobody came to help. And she was right. You know, 2,600 girls have escaped from being sex slaves to ISIS. 3,200 are still missing. Many of their men are dead in mass graves around Shingal Mountain, which is where they come from. And by the way, we used to, or we did, do refer to it as Sinjar Mountain, but the Yazidis call it Shingal. Their story is a brutal and terrifying reality in much of the Middle East today, where religion has become a code word for hatred, and marauding gangs of murderous men have become the new normal. You know, these ISIS fighters, the girls, these young Yazidi girls that I talked to, they told me that ISIS fighters would tie them up and leave them at the end of their prayer mat, and then they would bow to the east and pray and turn around and untie them and rape them. Who are these people? Who's supporting them? Who's allowing this to carry on? You know, while the world debates the parameters of genocide and wrings its hands over the scorched earth ISIS atrocities, the Yazidi people want to know why they aren't worth rescuing. They want their people back. They want recognition for the hideous crimes committed against them. And they want reassurance this will never happen again. This was why I followed your professor to Iraq, because in all of these stories that I cover in zones of conflict with always atrocities against women and girls, in Iraq, in Syria, I had never heard one person speak about the way forward. I'd never heard one person say, this is what needs to happen. And so when I saw on a group email that Professor Akhavan was talking about that, I thought it was the most important story, because this blood-soaked land is ancient Mesopotamia, and this diverse tapestry of villages, they managed for thousands of years to get along with each other. But the tapestry has been shredded. They hate each other. They have such revenge in their souls because of the terrible things that were done to them. And Paya McCoven said to me, the antidote for this is the language of human rights. And I thought, you know, it's practically become the center of the universe. We have this with this challenge to human rights. We have Trump coming in. We have atrocities being committed. And to me, it came together in a circle. And it was a circle to follow the advice that your professor had. He said the long-term solution is not military beyond gaining a ceasefire. It's giving the Yazidis a measure of justice to restore their humanity. And then listen to this, what he said. Then the object of pity becomes an agent of change. This is key in the way we look at the things that are going on around the world today. You know, those gentle Yazidi people, they settled there thousands of years ago. Their religion goes back to 800. They're farmers and shepherds, and they grow eggplant and tomatoes, and they herd their sheep high on the mountain in the spring and bring them down to the lower parts in the winter. But the menace that wrecked their lives on August the 3rd in 2014 has yet to be dealt with. Most Yazidis have never heard of the International Criminal Court. The concept of human rights is brand new to them, as it was to the women of Afghanistan when I started working there. But just as surely as night becomes day, they know they have been wronged severely, tragically, and so far they know they're alone in trying to right those wrongs. Everyone's been there. Amnesty International's been there. Human Rights Watch has been there. The UN has been there. But as you and I sit here today, 450,000 Yazidis are displaced or dead or being used as sex slaves. What are we going to do about this? Well, it was Chaim Akhavan who said we should try to start a truth commission. Because he said, there's a virus of violence spreading in the Middle East that is reaching the rest of the world. The attacks have a sameness about them, the seeds of genocidal violence. They always dehumanize. You can't kill people you have empathy for. Who's having this conversation? Is it not time that we all took part in this sort of conversation? Genocide is not a natural disaster like a tsunami or an earthquake that comes out of nowhere. As the professor explained, it's a political choice, an instrument of power that requires plans and resources, and there's always an incubation period. You know, we were speaking earlier about NGOs and humanitarian aid workers and all the people that are on the ground in these places. They all know. They can see it coming. It's like an approaching a thundercloud. They can see it. But what means do we have to stop it? There's always a cause for these exterminators that they're supporting. It's glorious to be a suicide bomber. It's glorious to rape the daughter of an infidel. You know, their stories are disturbingly similar, and they're scripted with a sense of ritualistic, carefully organized and precise extermination. Over there, they refer to the people of the book. The people of the book are the Christians and Jews, and as long as they leave and leave all of their goods and all of their money behind, they will not be killed when the caliphate is formed. They can leave, but anyone who is not of an Abrahamic religion is to be killed because they're considered infidels. What happens next is almost unspeakable. They round up the people and they begin their selections. And you end up with the older people being sent away, the disabled people being sent away, the young men being taken, the older men being beheaded, the young girls made sex slaves. And as they separate those girls, the kids were telling me that they take all the girls, and then they separate the pretty girls. Then they separate the girls with blue eyes. I mean, what kind of monsters are these, and who is supporting them? And why aren't we speaking more about it? While we were there, unbelievably, we managed, probably because of you, Barzan, we were sitting around one day and somebody mentioned prisoners, and as a journalist, you don't tell anyone I said this, Andrew. I'm ashamed to say it never occurred to me there would be ISIS prisoners. I thought they fought to the death. And someone mentioned prisoners, and we said, where are the prisoners? And Barzan said, they're here in Duhok. And we decided we wanted to get the interview, and we got the interview. But it was pretty shocking. You can find it all online. I asked them what I said to these prisoners as I interviewed one after the other. I said, what does ISIS want? They said, they want their flag everywhere. They want to kill people who aren't like them, and they want to make everyone live by the Quran. I said to one of them, I was really quite taken by what they thought they were getting away with. What did they think they were pulling off? I said, you're so into brutality and blood and misery. I said, I'm not from here. I'm a woman. I'm a mother. I'm a grandmother. Would you kill me? And the kid said, no, because I'm in jail. He said, ISIS would kill you. They have no compunction about leaving this ridiculous, totally unscripted ideology that they're hanging on to. I said to Paya McCoven, I said, I think they're all psychopaths. He said, no, they're ordinary people who are furiously angry with the way their lives have turned out, and they've been brainwashed. And that is a toxic mix. But I'll tell you another piece to the story. I know I have to move along here. You're going to get a hook and throw me out. There was a man, a Yazidi man came with us. His name is Hussein Hassoun. And I finished interviewing the prisoner whose job it was to match up four little Yazidi girls with each commander as sex slaves. Can you imagine? That's your job. And I finished interviewing him, and Hussein Hassoun walked up to him, and he got this close to his face, and he said, "I am a Yazidi man. I was on Shingal Mountain when you attacked. I forgive you." And the kid was stunned. He was stunned. He was completely shocked into silence. And then there were tears in his eyes, which says to me, plans like a truth commission can go forward. You can hopefully move with that kind of reaction. Now, that's a terrible story, but I want to tell you a story of an example of how human rights are indeed flourishing because the earth has shifted under the status of women. And this story even has to do with McGill. In Kenya, there were 160 little girls between the ages of 3 and 17 who decided to sue their government for failing to protect them from being raped. Who's ever heard of such a thing? It was astonishing to me that it could ever even happen. And it had a hook to Canada, because Canada is the country where the women sued the government for failing to protect them and won. You might not remember the balcony rapist case, but I can explain that to you later. So the human rights lawyers in Kenya contacted the human rights lawyers in Canada, and they said, "How'd you pull that off?" And the Canadian women said, including Pearl, how do you say, who teaches here, she was one of the lawyers, they said, "This is how we did it, and if you want us to help you, we will." And that began the most extraordinary case. People said, if those girls win this case, it is going to alter the status of women in Kenya, maybe even in all of Africa. The suit was the brainchild of a woman called Fiona Sampson, who runs an organization called the Equality Effect. And the Equality Effect takes on these kinds of cases using international human rights law to improve the lives of girls and women. So Fiona Sampson had to go over there and meet the woman who runs the shelter where these girls stay. And they stay in a place called Meru, which is 4 hours north of Nairobi, in a shelter called Ripples International. And this woman's name is Mercy Chidi. And I can tell you, Mercy Chidi is the Erin Brockovich of Africa. Nothing passes her. She's not scared of anybody. She says what has to be said. And both she and Fiona decided that the root of this problem was the fact that the rapists had impunity and the justice system failed to convict them. I mean, Kenya has laws. They don't call it rape. They call it defilement, heaven forbid. But the laws are never enforced, and the rape is on the rise. Hardly anyone gets arrested, and hardly anyone goes to court, and hardly anyone goes to jail. So the lawyers, the Kenyan women and the Canadian women, filed a suit that said the state is responsible for the police and the way police enforce existing laws. Since the police in Kenya failed to arrest the perpetrators and fail on an ongoing basis to provide the protection girls need, the state is responsible for the breakdown of the system. So they went to work, and with all due respect to the incredible things you do, watching you work is not something I like to do. These women were bivouacked in a hotel room in Nairobi. And you know how you have to prepare a case. You have to cross every T and dot every I and make sure every single word is working for your case. So I left them to do what they had to do. And I got in the truck and drove north to Meru because I wanted to meet those girls. I'm sure many of you have been to Africa. I mean, the drive from Nairobi to Meru is like going through storybook Africa. We went by tea plantations and banana farms. We passed those dark umbrella-like acacia trees, and we smelled the dry scent of the savanna. We saw bleating goats and signs that declared Jesus saves. They were dotting the landscape. We saw mango trees and roadsides drenched in pink and orange and red bougainvillea. We passed, they were banged up against those big fluorescent green billboards advertising safari.com, the local cell phone provider. All the way you could see old Africa and modern Africa bumping into each other. Then we got to Meru, and we turned down a rutted dirt road, and there was a canopy of beautiful flowering trees that joined over the road as though to give us refuge from the equatorial heat. And I noticed that hedges of purple azalea and yellow hibiscus were camouflaging a fence that was there to keep intruders away from this bucolic place that was a refuge for 160 girls who were poised to cut off the head of the snake that is sexual assault. The first child I met was called Emily, and it was the size of the girl that took my breath away. She was barely 4.5 feet tall, and her little shoulders weren't 11 inches apart. And I want to tell you, by the way, I don't go around interviewing kids who've been raped in order to get my story. I would never do that. These kids were told they had to tell their story to the court, and they were told I was coming, and they said, you can tell your story to her, and you will practice telling your story. It was the way it was working. But I was more than emotionally disturbed to meet these kids, and yet they were such terrific kids. Emily sat down to tell me her story. She's 11 years old. You know how 11-year-olds have that husky voice? She sounded like Walter Cronkite, for heaven's sakes. And she said to me, my grandfather asked me to fetch the torch. I was happy to do it, but it wasn't the torch that he wanted. When she brought the flashlight back, she said he took me by force and warned me not to scream or he'd cut me up. Along with thousands of men in Kenya and sub-Saharan Africa, Emily's grandfather has the demented view that having sex with a little girl will cure you of HIV/AIDS. And they think the smaller the child, the stronger the cure. But now Emily is taking the old man to court. And even Emily knew that this was history in the making. Emily's older sisters never dared to do this. Her mother never dared to do this. Her aunties and her grandmother never dared to do this. This little kid, along with 159 other little kids, knew they might be the ones to strengthen the status of women, to bring human rights to the girls of Kenya. Emily said to me, these men will learn they cannot do this to small girls. And you know, she's a victim, for sure. She's a victim. My God, what happened to this kid? But somehow that victim label was balanced with the empowerment she felt for taking on the country that allowed this to happen to her. But it was only 6 days since she'd been raped when I met Emily. And she was still complaining of stomach pain. She couldn't sleep. She said to me in her native Kiswahili, it hurts to go to the bathroom. And I'm accused as a journalist of not being culturally sensitive when I go to these places. This has nothing to do with culture. This has everything to do with crime. And it's about time we dumped our sensitivity when it comes to the safety of women and girls. In Kenya, kids raped every 30 minutes for these reasons alone. Some of them are as young as 3 months old. If they don't die of their injuries, they face this awful stigma that we have. And we have some of it here, too. The shelter workers told me nobody wants to have anything to do with a kid who's in a shelter or a kid who's been raped. One of the chapters in my book is called what it is because of what this woman said to me. She said, it's time. We said, the fault isn't ours. The fault is yours. These kids know who raped them. It was a father, an uncle, a neighbor, a priest, a teacher, the very people struck with the responsibility of taking care of little kids. But by now, their health is compromised. They may have any number of sexually transmitted diseases. They could be HIV positive. They've lost their chance to go to school because of the stigma. And so now, with no education and poor health and no means of financial support, they wind up where you and I see them in posters. And I look at those posters and I think, is this one of the things that's wrong? Is this why Africa can't get off its knees? It's surely one of the things that's wrong. And we know exactly what to do about that. But you know, even if it's the breadwinner who's guilty, the mother will say, don't say anything. If he goes to jail, we starve. As that woman said to me, we need to stand up and say, the shame isn't ours, it's yours. But you know, when I visited, there was another girl. She's called Lookaline, and she's 14 years old, and she was 39 weeks pregnant. I called back later, and she'd had a little girl, and she was okay. But my conversation with Lookaline really struck me. She's a victim, too, but she spoke like a girl who was empowered to make change. And she said to me, This happened to me on May the 13th at 2 o'clock in the afternoon in the year 2010. I will make sure this never happens to my sister. And I'm always dazzled by what these kids would do if they had a chance, right? If you had a chance to go to school, if you had a chance to gather the tools you need to make change, what would you do? And I said to her, what will you do when the baby comes? She said, I'll stay in school. Now remember, this is a test case. I'll stay in school because they've said the shelter will take care of the baby so I can finish school. And you know, I ask these kids all around the world, what would you do? And they tell me things like, oh, I wish I could be a lawyer. I wish I could be a doctor. I want to be the president of the country. I said to Lookaline, what would you do if you got this education? She didn't say, I wish, I want, if only. She said, oh, I'm going to be a poet. Not a poet. I don't even want my kids to be a poet. You'll starve to death. And with that, she pulls a book out she's been sitting on, and she said, do you want me to read you from my poetry book? I was there on a documentary for CBC Radio Ideas, and I recorded this. She read, here I come, walking down through history to eternity, from paradise to the city of goods, victorious, glorious, serious, and pious, elegant, full of grace and truth, the centerpiece and the masterpiece of literature, glowing, growing, and flowing, here, there, everywhere, cheering millions every day, the book of books that I am. This from a girl who's disadvantaged in so many ways it's hard to count them all. And yet, she was going to take on her government and sue them for failing to protect her. I'll just tell you an aside. When it played on the CBC, this is such a Canadian response, a professor from the University of Saskatchewan called the CBC and said, I will mentor that girl. She had to go through 87 layers of security. But again, today, as we sit here, Lookaline has a mentor. And she says she's moving right along. But you know, the reason the story really got me, I followed them for 3 years, was this was a journey about girls who dared to break the taboo on speaking of sexual assault. It was about women from two sides of the earth who came together to help these youngsters in their quest for justice. And it was about kids who were told, you have no rights. And they said, well, actually, we think we do, and we're going to chase them down. So the court case began on October the 11th, Girl Day, from the UN, named by Canada, by the way. And everyone involved said that if they won, this would create a hullabaloo of Shakespearean proportions. And frankly, there's nothing I like better than a hullabaloo of Shakespearean proportions when it comes to the rights of women and girls. So the case began, and the lawyers decided they would march from the shelter to the High Court. Well, they no sooner got on the street with all of their supporters, and the kids came pouring out of the shelter saying, we're marching with you. And the lawyer said, no, go back, it can't be identified. And they said, nothing doing. And all this is on video. They marched down with punching their fist in the air, yelling, haki yangu, which means these are our rights. Well, they got to the courthouse, and guess who was guarding the courthouse? The police. Now, in Kenya, if you're a kid and you report a rape to the police, you're likely to be re-raped. It was the women of Kenya who coined the phrase re-rape. So there are the police guarding, slamming the gates shut. The lawyers stopped in their tracks. Those kids were up those gates in no time. And they're looking around, looking at each other, and one of them started to laugh. And she said, look at the police. The very people who hurt us, who humiliated us, now they're scared of us. Anyway, they laughed, and finally they came down, and the gates opened, and the court case began. And on May the 27th of that year, the judge made his decision, and those little kids won. And they won it for 10 million girls in Kenya. And the fallout from that case is being felt all the way to today. You know, I tell you these stories to convince you the earth has shifted under the status of women and girls, but I need to say to you as I close, there's a potentially dreadful menace facing us now. The very rights that propelled women and girls to make change, they're under attack again. Certainly the rights of women, the rights of Muslims, Mexicans, the LGBTQ community, and everyone who's ever been caught in the crosshairs of Donald Trump. So I appeal to you, the legal minds of the future, the youth of McGill, the people, the architects of hope, I appeal to every one of you in this room today. Now is the hour to to pay attention. You know, it's not unusual to want to help someone in trouble, right a wrong, stop an injustice. What is exceedingly rare is that we actually become proactive and decide, this involves me. You know, you can see evil and look the other way. You're not going to get arrested. But if you decide to be altruistic, you have to have the courage to go ahead. Remember Hannah Arendt, the writer and philosopher, who spent much of her very interesting life trying to understand the nature of good and evil. She's the woman who went to Jerusalem to follow the trial of Adolf Eichmann, a man who bears much of the responsibility for the Holocaust. And she did that because she felt if she looked Adolf Eichmann in the face, she would see what evil was. But you know what? She looked at him, and what did she see? A pretty ordinary guy. And she concluded that evil thrives on apathy, and it cannot exist without it. Hence, apathy is evil. You see, when injustice encounters inertia, it uses that passivity exactly as though it were approval. And in the absence of protest, evil is nourished, and indeed, it can flourish. The nature of goodness, therefore, bears a very keen resemblance to intervention. People who seek to find meaning in their lives or simply want the quiet splendor of moral growth are obliged to get involved when something is wrong in the community, in the country, indeed, in the world. But most people, as theater critic Walter Kerr once put it, cast themselves in the role of spectator, whatever the provocation, to take action. They say, well, there's nothing I can do. I'm only one person. I'm not rich. I'm not famous. What on earth could I do? My personal favorite is a woman who said to me, well, what if I got involved and made a fool of myself? The problem with that kind of thinking is that innocent bystander is sometimes an oxymoron. People who do not intervene when something is amiss give tacit permission for injustice to continue. But none of this is easy. Upsetting the status quo is always tough. You sometimes have to brave the disapproval of your colleagues, the censure of your friends, even the wrath of society. It takes awesome moral courage to go against the grain. And it's been said, you know, that moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or even great intelligence. But I can tell you, it is the one essential, vital quality for those who seek to change a world that yields most painfully to change. Change doesn't happen because we want it to happen or because it's fair for a just society. Change happens because people engage in the process. People like you. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions? No questions? Thank you. No, I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you. Okay.
Well, thank you very much, Sally, and I think the response speaks for itself. And thank you for challenging all of us. We now have about 20 minutes for questions and answers. So please put your hands up and introduce yourself, and we can have our Q&A. Yes, gentleman over there.
Where are you? Oh, there you are. Sorry, I didn't hear you. Thank you.
Hello, thank you for your talk. My name is Elias Leon. I'm wondering, given all of your experiences and the stories you've learned in the field, particularly in Africa, I wonder why your honest thoughts on efforts, current efforts undertaken by the international community, especially the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. Do you think these are very effective? Do you think these are more an act of marketing or PR?
Listen to this. You think I'm not in enough trouble with the Taliban? Now you want to get me in trouble with everybody else. So if I can repeat, do I think enough is being done by the international community?
Yes.
No. So why do I say that? Where are the young women we were talking to over lunch? You know, it's so easy to trash the international community. It's so easy to say, oh, the UN is like this and it's like that. And indeed, it probably is. But the UN is all of us. You're the UN. I'm the UN. But we don't have that feeling, do we? We feel it's they. They are the UN. And we are listening. Until we decide we're all the UN, we're not going to make the changes that need to be made. And what can the international community do? You know, these issues are hard. They're complicated. Terrible things happen to people. You want change, you want it right now. And the UN sends in a team and says, we're going to have a study, and it'll be finished in a year. And as I was saying to these young women at lunchtime, these people are suffering 5 minutes at a time. That's not good enough. But it's not to say the UN is wrong or bad or lazy, all the kinds of things we tend to think rather than say. It means we have to find a better, more effective way. So if I were to tell all of you, look how smart you are. Look what you have to offer. Look what the tiny percentage of the population you represent, because you're so smart and because you know things and because you have vision. If I were to put all of you in a room and say, can't come out till you come up with a solution, you know, you will come up with brilliant ways to make change. But we don't do that. We don't appreciate change. We don't appreciate new. You know, what we're doing the world over today is costing a fortune, and it's not working. We need a better way. We don't need to dump everything. We need a better way. But it's you who know, you people who know the way. You have ideas. But what we do, especially with young people, is we say, oh, you know, we've already heard that, or we've already tried that. Don't be put down. You're the people who can say, meet me in such and such a room, we're going to come up with something. And the people won't make it easy for you, but yes, it needs change, and you're the ones that can make it, and I will support you. Tell me what you're doing, I'll come and write about you. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Hello. First of all, thank you for your testimony. So there's two parts to this. First of all, I want to congratulate you as a person, because I can hear in your voice how you're personally affected and sensitized and empathetic to all those things that you've been describing and all those people that you've taken the time to help. That's the person, the personal thing. Now the systemic thing. We have to remember that ISIS is the direct result of the political vacuum that was directly created by the invasion of Iraq 12 years ago, which itself was the direct result of the absolute greed for oil. Hence, what does this mean is that I would think that the vast majority of human rights violations and the greatest reason of all why groups like ISIS exist, it's because of the power vacuum created by the overriding interest of big corporations, which I won't call big corporations, I'm going to call them the warlords of big finance. Because the warlords of big finance are those who finance the warlords of ISIS. Let's remember that even Hillary Clinton, who talks about the rights of women, was captured herself by the warlords of big finance. Now, since you've been talking about education a lot in Kenya and everywhere, we shouldn't forget that the Kenyan government and all those societies where these things happen have been victimized by the total lack of the international community to respect socioeconomic rights, which are a complement to civil rights, and the right to education, the right to food, the right to jobs are all those rights which are socioeconomic rights and which are helping the rights of women. So my question to you is, can we complement this discourse of human rights and this discourse of intervening with a robust solution to combating the immense power of the warlords of big finance? That's my first question. My second question, from what you've seen, what are the original strategies that people in those countries, those women, have developed to themselves combat as opposed to basically emphasizing what Westerners are doing. Because it's good to emphasize what Westerners are doing, but what they locally, with their own cultural tools, have done to combat what they're undergoing.
Well, that's a very long list. Perhaps you're going to have to help me edit that. I'm going to start with the last comment because, first of all, it's the easiest, and I remember it the best. What are the women doing about it? What they're doing is getting an education. And education is the beginning of everything. You know that to be true. If you can't talk about it, you can't change it. So education allows you to have the unaltered view of the facts. Look what we're doing now with this false news syndrome. We've known for a long time that it existed, but at last we've taken it on. It is false news, although I see that Trump is using it to his advantage as well. So what do the women do? As I said to you, Facebook played a huge role in all of this because women saw, I'm thinking right now of the women of Afghanistan, they said, other people don't live like this. How come we live like this? And you have it pounded into that it's because this is your culture and this is your religion. It's not. It's neither. It's a habit. It's something that has gone on and it needs to be changed. So education is the beginning and the end, in my opinion, of all of that. As for the rest of the things you said, I don't want to speak as long as you did because we want to get on to another question. I don't feel that accusing everybody, business, Hillary, everybody, is the way to find a new starting point. You know, I wonder if I can tell this story. I'm going to tell this story. It's kind of convoluted, but I think you'll get my point. I met a young woman who works for a huge oil company who's in the pipeline business. And I said to her, when you were making your announcement about pipelines, I suppose you had to put the cheapest program in place in order to get the most money for your shareholders. Otherwise, your shareholders would dump you and your company would be in trouble. And I said, I'm sure you won't answer my question, but my question to you would be, did you have plan A, which would be the cheapest pipeline and perhaps the most problematic, but it would make the most money for the shareholder? And then did you say, well, in case the public respond, we'll have a plan B and we'll make it a little safer, a little better, but the shareholders will make less money. And I dare say you went to plan C, D, and E. I said, am I close? She said, you're spot on. But you know, sir, to change the world of money takes a tremendous amount of creativity. So a company that is going to put in a pipeline that is maybe going to hurt people is still responding to the shareholder. So I'm not convinced it is the owner of the company. I'm afraid that it's all of us who are investing and buying stocks in the company. So it's a complicated picture that involves, at the end of the day, every one of us. I buy your stock, you demand a bigger return, so I'll get more money, so I'll buy more of your stock, and then you hire a guy who's willing to do that. Do you remember that book, QB7, by Leon Uris? At the end of his book, he was talking about the Nazis, and at the end of it he said, every single one of us is guilty. So I come back to the same point. It's a little bit simplistic, given the detailed and interesting view you have, but it's not one person, it's not one company, it's not one executive, it's all of us. We own all of this. You have a question.
Yes, thank you. I'm one of the 15 raging grannies of Montreal.
Good on you.
Yeah. Well, you know, and as a Canadian, and you are one, is about this arms sales to Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is also selling arms and killing people in Yemen and that. So this is all about human rights and about us Canadians making money. And I'd like to have your reaction about this and Justin Trudeau and beyond. And now Freeland, who is trying to, will she change something? But it's a shame for Canadians. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate your question. And I have to tell you, I have very personal opinions on all of the things you said. They're probably very much in line with your own. But I'm not an expert on that. My work involves conflict and women and girls, and I wouldn't be the best person to answer that question because I wouldn't have enough data to prove my point. So I'm going to have to say I'm glad you're raising it, and I hope lots of people talk about it. Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Tim.
Last two, okay.
Hi, my name is Tim. I'm just wondering, like, as a journalist, how you stay safe while getting like deep access and maintaining journalism.
What do I say to Andrew? What are you going to do to keep me safe? How do you stay safe? Well, these are dangerous places. You have experience. You know when to take a chance and when not to take a chance, hopefully. You shouldn't go into that area if you don't have any experience. You should get someone like Barzan to take you. It is difficult. My children ask me that question too. But I think you can do your job. For me, personally, the less attention I bring to myself, the better. If I'm doing a television documentary, there's cameras and producers and sound people all around, you bring a lot of attention to yourself. And that's invariably when you get into trouble. So you do the best you can, but you need to get to the story. Payam and I were talking earlier about this Dr. Seema Samar, who's just a spectacular woman. And I've known her from the time the Taliban took over. And I stay with her family because that means I'm on the story 24/7. If I go to a hotel, I'm away from the story for 10 or 12 hours a day. And there's a trade-off, I'm sure. But I think you have to make personal decisions, and I think you have to make them based on experience. Last question.
So you spoke a lot today about Donald Trump and what him being president will mean for the future of human rights. And I was just wondering, as a journalist and an advocate for human rights, if you had the opportunity to ask him one question, what would it be?
When are you leaving? I only had one question to ask him. What's wrong with you? There's something wrong with him. He's not okay. This is not... I don't mean to be putting him down, I feel sorry for him that he has the vocabulary of a grade 4 student. He says a sentence, then he repeats 3 words of it, then 1 word. How long is it going to take till that's every cartoon in the land? He has no regard for people. Imagine... Did you hear Meryl Streep's speech after the... And I saw those clips over and over of him imitating a disabled person. What kind of a creep does that? Not to mention what he said about women. Not to mention what he said about Muslims and Mexicans. And there's something wrong with him. So maybe that would be my question. What's wrong with you? That would be the end of my interview. One more?
Yeah, thank you so much for having this last question. Thank you, Sunshine, for coming here to speak.
I can't hear you.
Oh, should I? Can you hear me now?
No.
I'll just try to keep louder.
Shout, yeah.
Okay, thank you so much for coming to speak.
Still can't hear you.
It works? Okay, great. Wait one sec. You spoke in your lecture a little bit about how the language of human rights as an antidote to religious hatred. And I was wondering if you could speak a little more about that.
As what?
The language of human rights as an antidote to religious hatred. And I was wondering...
To religious...
Hatred.
Oh, it's easy. You know what? We never speak in easy terms. We think we have to have a 5,000-word dissertation in order to respond to it. Whatever happened to that's not okay? Whatever ever happened to what? You're going to do that to her? I mean, where are we going with our... To be politically correct, heaven forbid, having spoken about Trump, we don't would like a little bit of that. But in terms of religious hatred... We don't ask people to prove where they got this data. And generally, we're speaking to people who can't read it anyway. But we try to be polite. And the language of human rights has to do with, I'm going to treat you the way I want you to treat me. And it's not complicated. And the more we complicate it, the less pressure we put on people to come around. So I think it's really plain stuff. That's why the declaration is so effective. Okay, thank you.
Well, Sally, I think I speak on behalf of everyone in this room that you inspired us, and we're so grateful that you would make time to come. And we here are in the world of the legal profession, you're in the journalistic profession, we all play with words. So I'll share something from the illustrious Rumi from my tradition, who says that we should raise our words, not our voice. It's the rain that grows the flowers and not the thunder. So I want to thank you very much for elevating our spirits with your wonderful words and for inspiring us. Thank you very much for coming.
Sending them a chunk or whatever, and it's like, am I going crazy?